So Tim says, now, you know, brothers and sisters, we're going to commit ourselves to winning people to Christ here at Cramble Chapel. Bob, would you come forward, please? What's that Bob's going to say?
Bob reaches up and gets the metal pole and goes back to that, from the front of the church to the back. And the door is never closed since.
And now both sides are full. Not meaning that you should open this door here, because it's a little different circumstance. And I want to be careful about that. Well, I want to use that illustration. The way the situation was, we needed to move. And we made a commitment to move. We started guest Sundays once a year, then twice a year, then four times a year, and we've already had two this year with a third one coming up. And the whole service, everything is geared to winning people to Christ. We pass out little cards, prayer cards, to every member of the church. Ask them to fill out the names of the people that they're going to be praying for and bringing. Turn in the cards in the collection. And then the staff of the church distributes the cards to the people to pray for them, and then the prayers will phone up and tell you, like, for instance, when I write down my friend's name, John, the person who gets my prayer card will phone me up and say, "Hello, Terry, this is Mike calling. Just want to let you know I'm praying for John." Like focused evangelism. And I think maybe that's one reason something's happening. So let's prioritize evangelism. Let's not beat around the bush. Let's not say everything we do is evangelism. Let's be wholly dissatisfied or have a holy dissatisfaction with what's going on in the past. Prioritize it in every way, shape, and form. Number two, first principle is we need to prioritize evangelism. I'd say the second principle is it has to be relational in nature. I've already talked a little bit about that as well. Theologically, we say it's got to be incarnational. You've probably heard that phrase. God was in Christ, reconciling the world to Himself. John chapter 1, verse 14. And we beheld His glory. The glory is, God was in Christ, and we beheld His glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father. Jesus became flesh, incarnated Himself to reach us. God didn't send a message, as we say in cliche. He sent a messenger. God could have announced from the sky the eternal gospel, or only given us the printed word. But He paramountly gave us His own Son, who came and walked in our world. Can you just get over the timing of God doing this? Could you imagine if it was 1991 with ABC, NBC, and CNN? And what's your greatest network here in Australia? I've got to be totally contextual here. Yeah. I watched them all last night. They all had the same story on. The same news. So anyways, you know what I mean. Could you imagine 6,000 press there to cover the story of the crucifixion? It just wouldn't have been. It just wouldn't have somehow or other been appropriate. God did it so perfectly the way He sent His Son. And at an apex of learning and culture, so that the words of Christ could be recorded 500 years before, not the same. 500 years after, not the same. God's timing was beautiful. As Jesus Christ, the incarnate God, lived among us and we beheld His glory. That's the way we've got to bring the gospel to people. We've got to be where they are. I don't know, do you still have gospel services on Sunday nights in Australia?
There.
Some places. We found, and I'm not putting things down, remember I said anything can be used? But let's try to strategize. We have found, generally speaking, that Sunday night, not a lot of guests come to evangelistic services. Maybe some places they do, and if they do, great. At our church in Vancouver, we basically don't even have Sunday night services, period, now. The idea is we go out there and we're trying to be with people. I often ask Christians, how many meals have you had with Christians in the last 6 months? How many meals have you had with, my friends use the term, pre-Christians? We kind of think everybody just needs to hear. And people aren't that negative. So how many meals have you had with pre-Christians lately? 10 to 1? 10 to 0? It's just quite amazing when we stop and think about it. We've got to, when we incarnate, not only have the tone of communication that's relational, we've got to be where the people are. Becky Pippert entitled her book, Out of the Salt Shaker and Into the World. We've got to be where the non-Christians are. It's about 1 minute to 5 minutes to 11. I've got a bunch of things more to say on this, but I think we've got to stand up and stretch. You know John Stott? When John Stott gives a long talk, halfway through he says, "Now we've got to stand. As Socrates said, the mind cannot take in what the bottom can't accept or endure." Endure, that's it. Okay, our first point was prioritizing evangelism. The second one is we've got to be relational in nature. And in relational, it's not only the tone of communication, which we've talked about, it's that incarnational side, where the people are. Joe Aldrich said in his book, Lifestyle Evangelism, the average person, when he becomes a Christian, or she, within 2 years, loses all meaningful contact with their non-Christian friends. Now, isn't that interesting? And I know what it's like. When I became a Christian in grade 12, I was so happy to become a Christian. I was with the in-group of kids, big long table in the lunchroom. The Christian sat at a little square table. No reference to shape, just the numbers of people available. And so when I was converted, I left the long table and went to the square table. And all the rest of my friends, I never even thought about for evangelism. It just wasn't the mood of the day to think of winning your friends to Christ. So I was selfishly, if I could use those words, appreciating the good part of being a believer, in with the Christians, feeding and feeding and feeding. And I, to this day, regret that I didn't take the opportunity I had with all those kids. Only one became a Christian. And he came to me, not me to him. His father made him take carpentry class. He didn't have any idea which end of the hammer to hold. And I happened to be in carpentry class too, and I knew which end to hold. And so I always got him as my partner. I always let him be my partner, and I held the hammer while he held the nail. And we did well together. And so he always appreciated that. So one day he finally came and asked me if I could have a book on how to become a Christian. And so I went to the preacher who I was finally converted from, the man who was talking the night when I accepted the Lord, and I asked him if I could have a book for a friend. And I was so surprised. He said, "Here, take two." It never even dawned on me that Christians are supposed to go out there and win non-Christians to the faith. We've got to be out there where the people are and not think in terms of what is good for us. University Chapel, I say it as I say with all sensitivity, is too much into our own worship, and we have to be, but without at the same time having that counterpoint. And they're concerned and they're really working away at it. They just hired a new senior minister just this last month with that in mind, etc. So we've got to be where the people are. Third point, and I've already mentioned this, it's got to be biblically strong. In fact, I've probably thoroughly gone over that. Be really careful, my friends, pardon me for saying this too, not to get out on personal whims, on personal issues, and on distractions. Try to be down the middle Christians. There are certain things that people get carried away on, and I think as a result, sometimes aren't as balanced as they could be. I almost hesitate to say what some of them are, but sometimes we talk more about the gifts of the Holy Spirit than the Holy Spirit, as an example. Or the details of prophecy rather than the fact that Christ is coming again, and we need to be serving in light of that. We can sometimes get carried away on the creation ideas that we may have, scientific or non-scientific, and forget that the Scripture is a theological textbook. Genesis is not a scientific text. So we can get a little distracted on all of these side issues. And what we've really got to be is so totally centered on Christ and then out there relating to the people. So let's be highly biblical and balanced. John Stott is, in my opinion, the epitome of wisdom and godliness wrapped into one person. Talk about a balanced individual. How many have ever heard John Stott in person or on a tape? He is so godly. It's just absolutely incredible. I remember I was visiting with him during that Lausanne conference, Cedric, in 1974. My wife Joan and I happened to, over the way things happened, become his friends. And so we were having coffee with him one day in Lausanne. They drew up a covenant, a doctrinal statement at the end of Lausanne called the Lausanne Covenant. They had to draft a theological committee to draw together the document. All the people's submissions. Study it, write a proposal, pass it out to everyone for reconsideration, and then rewrite the final draft, pass that out for acceptance. They have to choose a committee and they have to choose a chairman. So they choose John Stott as chairman. It's just natural. They say he had such a high IQ when he went to take honors at Cambridge, he couldn't decide which field to take honors in, so he just took honors in both. And he's got an IQ of a 200 or something. And so they choose John Stott, brilliant and godly. And I wonder which of the two is more important sometimes. Very interesting. And so we're having coffee, Joan and I, with John Stott right at the end of the conference. All his work as Lausanne covenant chairman is over, and we're talking about our sinfulness. He said, "Oh, Terry, Joan, I'm so sinful. I'm so sinful. You know what I did yesterday? I spoke curtly to a man." He said, someone came into the conference office 2 days after the submissions were due and insisted that his submission be included in our consideration. And I tried to explain to him it was already done. It was late. And he was rather demanding. And he said, I had to speak curtly to him that the time was over. He hadn't been to bed the whole night before, John, drawing up the final draft. I mean, you or I would have been yelling, "Who murdered her?" And he spoke curtly to the man. And so the man went off to the conference grounds. And he went back to work, and he couldn't work. He was so convicted of talking curtly to a brother. So he got up and went out. It was a big conference, 4,000 people, wasn't it, Cedric? He went off to the conference grounds to find the man whom he'd wronged and said, "Oh, here you are. I want to apologize. I shouldn't have spoken to you as curtly as I did." And the man just broke down and said, "I'm sorry. It was I that should apologize, not you." That's the tenor of godliness that that John Stott has, that sensitivity. Well, he came to Vancouver, and I went to one of his lectures about that same time, and he talked on the subject Between Two Worlds. And now he's written a book on it. I like to recommend books all the time. Read Joe Aldrich's books, General Persuasion and Lifestyle Evangelism. Read Becky Pippert, Out of the Salt Shaker and Into the World. Read David Watson's I Believe in Evangelism. Absolutely fantastic. And then John Stott's classic book. It's the best book on preaching there is. Between Two Worlds.
My position in Australia under the title of I Believe in Preaching.
Interesting.
We have a mission set.
Boy, these Australians, you know, you've got to do your own titles even, eh? Does John even know that? No, I'm just joking. That book, I Believe in Preaching, was entitled in the original Between Two Worlds, which gets across the point. He said, you've got to have one foot firmly planted in your theology and one foot firmly planted in the world in which you're serving. Billy Graham in the old days used to say, the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other is how you preach. In a sense, that's what John Stott's saying. Very biblical, but very relational, informed. So what you're saying meets today's people where they're at. So highly biblical, but very relevant. And the fourth and last point, then we'll have a few discussion times, a few questions and some discussion. Let's be contemporary, creative, thorough, up-to-date, and professional. Contemporary, creative, thorough, professional, up-to-date, doing everything we do well. I happen to spend most of my life in the business community in Canada, partly because we have a television program that's across the whole nation, and it's a rather large budget that we raise about $2 million a year to pay for it. And we don't raise it on the air. I go and knock on doors to raise the money. So I'm often in the offices of the presidents of corporations, Christian gentlemen and women, presidents and leaders of their companies or corporations, raising the support to pay for the program. And oh, I love to be with people that do things well. I was in an aeronautical manufacturing firm in Ontario last year. They make some of the parts that go into the space program. This man, the president, strode me through as only an achiever could stride you through the plant. Boom, boom. He looked a little bit like Superman. He was about so big, it made me feel insignificant and nobody. And he was smart and good-looking and dressed right, and the office was perfect, and the secretary was fantastic. And I remember walking through this plant, and everybody almost saluted him type of thing. He knew every little detail, and he'd only been in the business 2 years. His previous business had been building yachts, luxury yachts. But his whole modus operandi, his whole way of operating, professionalism, do what you do well, And they were in their machining of these parts that go into the space program, down to fractions of a hair dimension, doing things perfectly. I've got various friends that excel in athletics, excel in academics, excel in business, excel in what they do, and oh, I just love it. And you know when you find somebody that's good at what they're doing, they don't even have to boast about it. In fact, they don't boast. They don't need to boast. I just love professionals. I love to see things done well. And I love to see things done well for the kingdom of heaven. I just glory it when I see people putting their best foot forward. Doesn't the Bible say that children of the world are often wiser than the children of light? Boy, if we ran some of our churches the way we ran our businesses, I think we'd be booming. So why run the booming for the vocation instead of our avocation, which is serving the Lord? So let's be thorough. Let's do what we do with planning. We have an office in Vancouver. We try to do things well in our size of operation. We've got the best computer that we possibly could have. We have a full-time computer operator. We try to put out the best product of literature, the best product of the program. We try to have the best guests in the world. Not that we're big time, not that we're boasting, but the gospel deserves that kind of attention. We analyze, we criticize ourselves, our monthly prayer letter that goes out. Four of us on the staff work it over for a full day, once a month. Before, we heard that you're not supposed to be involved in fundraising, you're supposed to go and somehow or other in your closet and pray and hint like crazy, and then things will all come through. As a matter of fact, what helped me really on fundraising, just as a little aside for all of you who have to fundraise, this is for free. I do these lectures all across the world actually on fundraising for the Billy Graham and for the Lausanne and all that, because, you know, whoever expects a Plymouth Brethren to be, and a Canadian, to be involved in fundraising, it's just perfect. So it disarms everybody. I get in front of an audience of skeptics and I say, okay, if you think that I'm an American, and most people in the audience are Americans, so I'm doing that too. I said, if you think I'm American, I want to relax you all. I'm a Canadian, and I'm a Plymouth Brother. Any more questions? And they all kind of relax that this isn't going to be anything slick. Amy Carmichael said once, there are four ways to raise money. Three are biblical, one is not. She said the first way is to go into your closet and pray, but don't tell anybody you were in your closet and you prayed. Number two is to go out and work for it. Make some tents and pay your own way. The third way is to ask for it. And a huge chunk of the Bible says, command those who are rich in this world's goods to be generous and lay up treasure in heaven. Prepare for the offering when I come. The offering for Jerusalem, says St. Paul. The whole Bible's talking about stewardship. So Amy Carmichael said the third way is to ask. And the fourth way is to hint. The first three are biblical and the fourth is not. So our style of ministry in our organization was a highly hint for many years. We used to write out prayer letters that talked about everything under the sun and then say, please pray about it, brothers and sisters. Instead of saying, we need funds, etc. So we evolved over the last 20 years. Before, we'd send out prayer letters four times a year because we didn't want to bug our mailing list, we used to say. I said that to one person rather proudly one day. Pride's a bad thing. And I said, no, we only send out four mailings a year. And the person said, oh, that's interesting. Most people pay their bills 12 times a year, once a month. And out of sight, out of mind, if they get your mailings four times a year and they miss one, it's 6 months before they hear from you again. And so you're bugging your supporters, telling them what the Lord is doing. You're giving them a favor to pray intelligently when you won't give them the information. Oh boy, I got just cut down to size like you couldn't believe. We started sending out monthly mailings now to our constituency, and our income went up something like four times just over that one little thing of changing our mailing patterns. Everything we do, we try to do well for the kingdom of heaven. The programs. Have you ever been to a church where you have your service on Sunday for the neighborhood, and the hymns are sort of thrown together at the last minute, sitting in the front row, or somebody just asked the last second to come up and take part or whatever. Do you know what they do at Granville Chapel now? They have a ministry committee of 4 to 5 people that plans every single service, every little bit of detail, months in advance. And every one of us that are going to take part, every Sunday at least 7 or 8 people take part. Everyone who's going to take part gets a letter saying what they're going to be doing. Even the instructions for the prayer are outlined. What to put in your prayer. Some adoration of the Lord. They use the ACTS acronym. A-C-T-S. Adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and then the supplication. And everything is planned. And every Sunday is different. Some Sundays, Tim, our minister, acts out a sermon in drama style. Other Sundays, a sermon may be at the beginning instead of the end. Other times, little kids in Sunday school may be up all in an orchestrated part to do what we do well. So the brethren had a huge conference last December, a year ago, in Chicago, in Detroit, actually. Put on by Interest Magazine, the Brethren magazine for North America. They had 1,200 people at the conference. It's the best conference I've ever been to, any denomination, Lausanne and Billy Graham's Amsterdam included, was the Brethren Conference Detroit last year. I tell you, we've turned the corner and things are picking up. And that conference just was so professional, so well done, right down to the sound system, the PA, the scheduling, the workshops, and they had Tim from Granville Chapel come and do a workshop on how to run a Sunday morning service. A whole workshop just on how to run a Sunday morning service. And I went to back Tim. And I'll tell you, it was the best workshop I've been to in years. Just to plan the Sunday morning service. In other words, it doesn't by accident work out. Creative, fresh, alive, dynamic. My kids will not miss Sunday morning. That really says something about the thoroughness that's done there. This afternoon I'm going to talk a lot about the practical sides of creativity. The evangelistic Bible studies, the friendship banquets, the guest Sundays, the affinity group outreach functions, and I'll explain all of those things this afternoon. But what we do in all of these things, let's do well. Some questions. You've been listening so attentively, and so far only 2 people fell asleep. And so that's better than average. And maybe some questions, comments, helpful insights to what you're doing here in Australia. Nothing that I've said is new and startling. Any one of you could have said exactly the same things. But the idea is, let's orient ourselves and keep plodding, pushing each other, prodding and pushing each other forward. That's what I'm doing this morning. And I'd like you to help in the process.
So you say that some of the success is you've got full-time staff and some...
Yes, actually, that was my number one point to bring this morning, and I didn't happen to bring it up. I'd written that down. Number one. The churches with the pastors in North America are growing to a church, almost. The churches without the pastors, almost to a church, are not growing. It's become that evident. In 1830, when the Brethren were founded, it was a different era. There was an era of aristocracy, an era of landed gentry, and many of the early Brethren leaders were clergymen. In fact, most were clergymen. And all were in the positions of society where they had all kinds of time. So they were full-time workers, every one of them. Our society today is exceedingly complex. Our schedules are murderous. Nobody can run a church part-time. We need full-time staff. We need a lot more full-time staff in all of our churches in North America. And I would suggest you aim that way here in Australia. But don't aim at bargain basement salaries, bargain basement treatment. When you're hiring pastors, pay them properly. Don't let them be plagued with the problems and the insecurities of where's the next paycheck going to come from. And I definitely recommend, and this is why it's so good for me coming from Canada. I'm not stepping any toes. I don't know a single thing. I've not been primed by one person on one point. Salaries properly paid, organized, well done, we absolutely need. And encourage young men and women into the ministry. When I first went to seminary in 1964, people called it cemetery. They were against seminaries. You got to learn from the Lord, from the Holy Spirit, they would say. And yet, the preacher was there from Sunday, and he preached. I could never quite figure out the inconsistencies of traditionalism. That was only traditionalism when it wasn't really biblical. I'd go to Fuller Seminary, and that was really looked upon as liberal in those days. And I remember going to a missionary conference with the Brethren in Los Angeles, and somebody said, what do you do? I said, well, I'm at Fuller Seminary. Oh, that's nice. I went and talked to somebody else. I mean, they just didn't want to talk to this guy who was a cemetery. And one of my good friends, a very bright guy who taught philosophy at USC, the University of Southern California, he used to say, you know, Terry, it's funny. I go to USC. I teach in the philosophy department, and I'm totally accepted. You go to a theological school, it's evangelical, and you're suspect. You know, we're silly sometimes in our ways of holding on to the old ways. And so we discourage young men from seminary training back 30 years ago. We're paying the price in Canada today badly. We can't find the pastors. I'd say virtually every single Brethren church in Vancouver today is trying to find a pastor, and they can't. There aren't enough around because we didn't send the 20-year-olds 20 years ago to seminary, so we don't have the 40-year-old pastors today to take over the larger growing Brethren works. So encourage young men and women into the ministry. Encourage them well. And congratulations, Emmaus, for the work that you're doing and for the tones I'm developing here. That maybe is the number one need in assemblies in North America and probably here. Better and more pastors. Where the church is run like a church. In other words, if all the various churches are growing have found things, let's see what they found and do them. Somehow or other, we've got the idea that's anti-pastor. That wasn't the original Brethren principle at all. It's something that sort of crept in along the way. Those are my thoughts. Another question or comment?
Do the Reverend churches over there have like a corporate strategy to plan for Canada as a whole or the states as a whole?
That's a very, very intelligent question. How can we, as a non-denominational denomination, you know, function? You know, we really should be extinct. It's just the goodness of the Lord that's kept us even alive as a non-denomination for all these years. A loose affiliation of some sort is necessary. What is turning, and I believe for my traveling around the world, I believe the strongest area of Brethren, and pardon me for saying this, in the world today, is North America. Because of that. Interest magazine in Chicago, and oh, do they get criticized. They've had hate mail circulated last year, all over North America, with moral innuendos and everything, by conservatives, threatened by these guys who are so conservative. It's not even funny, but they're just trying to get the job done. The people that put on that conference, which I say was the best conference I have ever attended in my life, 1,200 people in Detroit, Bill Connard and Bruce McNichol are the two leaders of Interest Magazine. It used to be called Letters of Interest when it was just letters stapled together and from workers, and so it became Letters of Interest Magazine, and then they dropped the word letters, and it's Interest Magazine. They are trying their best to coordinate activity. So they have five people on staff. I forgot the exact title. Maybe somebody here knows what it's called. It's a church development, church consultation team. So if a Brethren church somewhere in North America wants to grow better, wants to analyze what they're doing, in other words, wants to be professional, they call Interest Magazine and say, we want a church consultant. And I tell you, these five consultants are so conservative, it's not even funny. And they come in, and they say, look at the church, what they're doing, and then pass on ideas from other places. That's where we lose, by not having a hierarchy, by not having a head office that comes in and says, okay, now this is what they're doing in Vancouver, in Victoria, you ought to do this also. And so we lose from that. Now, there are certain strengths in independence. There are certain strengths, too. But on almost everything, a strength has a counteracting weakness. And so if you could, you know, work toward a fellowship of strategic planning. And it would take different forms in different countries based on the circumstance. Vancouver right now has a very happy, what would you say, interrelationship among the churches. It's very, very happy. We've got the whole spectrum, but they all love each other and talk to each other. That's the one happy thing in the Vancouver scene. But we're not really strategizing quite enough. But you'll find when some good ideas start happening in one place, other churches will hear, so let's facilitate the process. Good question. Work toward it.
As you are moving from traditionalism into creative operations, how do you deal with resentment and opposition?
Yes, yes. But you see, in a way, I'm the right person to talk today. In a way, I'm the wrong. Because I'm involved in interdenominational work. I have a sidelight, and that's opening up the brethren. That's my little hobby. And so I often see, I'm an evangelist. Everybody's for evangelism. I speak in the most conservative assembly in the city of Vancouver every Sunday before Christmas now for 22 years. I mean, they won't even accept the moderate assemblies, but they accept me, and I'm just interdenominational. Because I'm an evangelist. It's sort of like apple pie, mother in the flag, and evangelism. And I just love the Lord. And I just love people. They meet the Lord. And so that's why I speak in these kind of contexts. That is part of the answer. It's the tone and the way in which we bring creativity. And the bottom line. If our bottom line is to bring more glory to the Lord and bring more people to Christ, then a lot of the opposition tends to relax more. But the conservatism of people. Now, conservatism doesn't mean right wrong, in my opinion. It more or less means personality. It means age. It means temperament. For instance, I have one lady who works on my staff who's 40 years old. She's lived in the same bedroom for 40 years. She's a single lady. And change for her is just astounding. It's change. Conservatism, to me, a definition is slowness to pick up change. Because we all adapt. It's just quickly or slowly. And so whenever we do something at our office, it's new, like we move our office, buy a new computer. She always comes and says, Terry, I don't think we need to. What we're doing right now is working quite well. 6 months later, she comes in and makes a big donation to pay for the new move. And all it was a 6-month time lag from everybody else because she's single, lives in her own same bedroom for 40 years and parks her car in the parking lot slightly offline every day. So that's just the way she is, you see. And so I've learned this over the years. People aren't opposed to change. Not really opposed to more effectiveness. They're just conservative, and something that's happening too quick is threatening. And so to try to relieve some of the threat. And I guess you don't want to move too quickly to insult others either. It's a matter of moving wisely forward. You've obviously got something in mind. Maybe you could help a little bit with the answer to your question. How have you found it to help to innovate change?
Well, in personal experience, we have a real desire to break from tradition and enter into a more kind of explorative area. And we have been very conscious of certain people who will not move from their old mindset and even try to explore new avenues of service. And sometimes we get very difficult and very hard resentment and feeling towards this change. And sometimes it's very difficult to know how to deal with these brothers and sisters, you know, in the Lord.
That is so profound. It's so difficult to know what to do. Time helps that. After a period of time of proving that we're not radical, that we're not throwing out everything of value, proving that we're even more effective, and even sometimes some of these come by. Maybe old Marshall Shepherd, who founded Regent College, nobody even knows this. Regent College in Vancouver, have you heard of it? Regent College is a school that many of these people I met at last summer. It's a theological school of the first order. It's world class in Vancouver. Theological, graduate theological school on the level of Fuller Seminary was started by brethren, by one man who never even finished high school, never went to theological school. He was a man that married my wife and I when he was 78. He died at 90. Marshall Shepherd was his name. In fact, they even have the chair of New Testament theology at Regent College. It's called the Marshall Shepherd Chair of New Testament Theology. Marshall Shepherd was the leader of Granville Chapel, and that's one reason Granville Chapel never got stuck in the doldrums. He never wanted to listen to negativism. And he always said, and pardon me for saying this is Marshall Shepherd said it, he said, Terry, don't worry about the older folks, they're dying. Worry about the next generation. And now I'm saying that in a gentle context, that we can't necessarily change sometimes, and it's not right to expect sometimes some older folks' minds to be changed. And maybe we just have to go on with the job when it really comes down to it. If we let minority rule, we're in danger. And that's one of the problems in brethrenism, is when we have a group together and we want to have unanimity 9 can be for something, 1 not, so therefore we don't go ahead and all lose. I tend to lean a little bit more toward a majority rule than a minority rule. In other words, unanimity is minority rule. The 1 no rules, not the 1 yes. And not the 9 yeses. And so we have to be sensitive and careful and know when to launch out. Now the funniest thing is, the brethren were started by men in their 20s and 30s. How people in their 60s and 70s, I'm an old timer too, I'm 48, I'm ready to retire. How old people like me think that we, you know, should dictate for the next generation. We've got to learn humility. And I love older, humble people like Marshall Shepherd, who founded Regent College. Say, we can't listen to the negativism, Terry. We've got to press on. I guess there's no real easy answer. It's demonstrating love, demonstrating practicality, and spirituality along the way. And I guess the bottom line is the same in any family, in any marriage, in any church. What's the word? Communication. And try to have church management that is majority rule, if at all possible. We in Vancouver are kind of progressive. We have women taking part in our church in Vancouver, and fully. And we even have a church with women elders. So that really will upset the whole apple cart today. I just do that for pure fun, because I'm going back to Vancouver in a couple of weeks. And I remember when we came to the vote at Granville Chapel, we had 18 elders, which is a little too many. They have 5 now, and they're growing as a church. Very interesting. We had 18 elders, so we discussed this subject thoroughly and came to the conclusion, 18-0, that women should have full part. The 18 elders included 2 doctors of theology. Very interesting. They made the mistake, though, of putting out a survey to the whole church to see what the church thought. All the men voted yes for full women's participation. All men. All women under 40. And no women over 40. In other words, it was personal comfort zone thing. And unfortunately, in that particular case, they set back the church 2 or 3 years by the way it was handled. The elders, after a big discussion, had already come to the place of mature discussion. I was in on them. I was an elder. And we went and we talked and we talked and we talked this thing through. In the beginning, there were some people opposed. But by communication, we elders decided that the Scripture taught full participation. And so we didn't then let the elders majority, you know, the elders rule. We went and put a survey out, and that threw everything into a tizzy. So you just have to use discretion, wisdom, and have church management that operates that way. Any more questions?
Does your church creativity come about by just the elders of the church coming together, or is there some pattern of organizing this?
Yes, that's a very good question. I'd say in that particular case, the answer is yes. The elders were too large when they were 18. Every discussion took too long. The elders are down. They're a little too small right now. They're 5. They should be more like 7 or 8, which I've just found in management is a good number for communication and variety of input. But yes, have the agenda set to discuss strategy. We have a phrase in all the work we do of creativity. See, I work mostly in interdenominational evangelism with fairly large crusades of hundreds and 200s of churches at a time. And what we do in most of our planning is work on the principle of ownership. People want to own the idea, not have it imposed upon them from without. So we don't like the idea of autocratic. You see, when people are against one-man rule, pastor, they get the wrong idea. Any pastor that's going to be a one-man ruler shouldn't be the pastor in the first place. A real leader involves the people. That's what leadership is. The definition of a good leader? Have at least 1 follower. Not be the person that's just dominating the whole show. A very good leader has all these people that he is or she is leading. And so ownership is the big word in creativity. So people feel it's their thing. And that's what I like about Granville. Even on the Sunday morning, they've got about 7 or 8 people, and not the same 7 or 8. And our ushers who take the collection are girls 20 years old. This whole idea of the oldest men in the church are the ushers always is restricting. They don't need their ownership. They've got the ownership. And they do a good job. This is totally positive. But what about the people that don't get the job? When I was a brand new Christian, they got me up there in the pulpit being the chairman. And then they had a quartet, and I couldn't sing, so I became the speaker. And all these little things that helped to get me involved, I don't know if I would have stuck to it. So involve the people with ownership. And so I noticed they're always, at Granville and all the works that we do, everybody has a place. And Bill Hybels from that Willow Creek Community Church is so strong on this. He says everybody has a ministry. Combine that ministry with a passion, and you're going to have something happen. You have to give the people the opportunity. Very good question. Yes. Strategic planning. Maybe the most needed thing in brethren churches today is strategic planning that then leads to churches run like churches, run like businesses. What's wrong with that? What are we doing right? Keith said it so well when people are coming in the door even. Body language tells a whole lot. Let's work all these things out. We have welcoming committees with little badges and roses on. When people come into church, these people are standing at the door to welcome them in, standing at the door to welcome them out. Afterwards, we have coffee every Sunday, immediately following the sermon, and invite everybody to stay. The church ends at 12:15 to 12:20. My wife and I don't leave there till 1:15 on Sundays. And I make a personal point, when I'm sitting in the audience, I only speak once or twice a year, when I'm sitting in the audience at our own home church, I zoom to the door afterwards and catch every person going out that I don't recognize. And just try to befriend them. It's all sort of strategic thinking of how do we do the job better to get people involved. We have nurture classes for brand new people to sign up and learn what it means to become a Christian. All these mega churches of 1,000 people or more are doing something right. Well, let's learn and do it right too. Now, I happen to like small better than big, after all I've said. Now, I don't mean small by 25 or 50. I think small is 200 to 300. Anything over 500, you start losing involvement unless you've got a management team that's absolutely incredible and then has 100 departments with 5 people in every department. When we do outreach banquets, friendship banquets, the churches of 2,000 people, their banquets aren't as good as the churches of 200 people putting on their banquet. Because when there's 1,000 to 2,000 people in the church, everybody says, let somebody else bring their friends. The banquet will work. We'll pray for you. When you get a church of 200 people and they're having an outreach banquet, everybody says, boy, you know, if I'm not there, it's not going to really work. And, you know, I'm a part of this church. Ownership is high. My favorite churches are 200 to 500 people, which is interesting. In other words, I'm not boasting about the 15,000 or the mega church. But I'm a little bit worried about little struggling churches of under 200 or under 100. We've got to maybe think how we're going to maybe even amalgamate or something so we get threshold numbers. So our youth have got friends.
The average church in the assembly in New South Wales is 51.
Oh, that's shocking. I wasn't primed ahead of time on anything, yes.
With that in view, I'm wondering what the population of Vancouver is by comparison. I guess I'm looking at the percentage of Christians in the population. We don't have churches of that number, and we have our Sydney population. I guess it would be 1.5 million, maybe. Somebody would know more accurately.
2.5 million.
2.5 million. We ended up with about only 2 or 3%.
Okay. About 2% are Christian. Vancouver is identical. Vancouver's identical. Our church attendance is 2% in Vancouver of our population. We're a small city. We're 1 million in the city, 2 million in the environment. You're 2 million, 3 million city, 4 million, 4.5 million environment, I've been told. So you're at least double the size of Vancouver. Same number of Christians in the population. Now, I don't like to say, hey, we're all perfect, you're all bad. I just never like people from another place coming saying how great they are. So I'm not trying to say that at all. What maybe, and this is a personal point of view, I think small churches ought to amalgamate. I'm even recommending that some brethren churches in Vancouver amalgamate. It is good to spawn new works, and apparently Parramatta has just started a new work here that's absolutely phenomenal. In this particular situation, it's time to grow. But if a church is 51, and it's been 51 for 10 years, and another one's 51, and it's been 51 for 10 years, maybe 102 together would have a threshold number that might make some things more effective. I'm saying this as a maybe. And in other words, that could be part of strategic thinking. Like, we find young people particularly need a threshold number of other young people. We lose so many of our kids from little churches because they have no friends that are Christian. And so these are things, maybe strategic thinking. Like, see, I have the beautiful advantage. I can say anything, and then I'm gone tomorrow. And so, you know, you're not going to be mad at me, whereas if one of you stands up and says something, you know, somebody else may get mad. Yes, Keith.
Assemblies of Melbourne have amalgamated, mm-hmm. Penfigali and Heathmont.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both of those were too full for their buildings, but
yes.
They amalgamated and made a new building.
Yes.
A lot of people criticised that, but I think it was ideal in the sense they have far more potential than they ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, say, having 90 families involved in both churches, now they've got 180 families.
That's interesting.
And a huge, huge youth program.
That is something, there's something to be said for that. And here I've just said this, and I don't know of a single case in Canada of amalgamation. And here I'm telling you guys that, and you've already done it in Australia. But that's something that's been in the back of my mind for a long time. That our churches sometimes are too small to really be effective. Now, there's another way to make that one church bigger within itself. You know, so in other words, I'm not saying you have to amalgamate. Yes? Sunday school in North America isn't as in as it was 30 years ago. Granville Chapel had a Sunday school of 250 children 20 years ago, 25 years ago. They had a Sunday school of 7 4 years ago when we went off to University Chapel. And that's one of the reasons our kids had no peers. Now, through the commitment and the dynamic of the church, the Sunday schools come back on. And now we're back up to 50 to 100. But Sunday schools take a lot of creativity, a lot of freshness today, and real commitment. But there's still a huge role for Sunday school. But it's not just a matter of opening up and everybody in the neighborhood sends their children. It takes strategic thinking. And what we have found, again, ownership involvement. We have the kids taking part in services all the time, different kinds of things to give them a real sense of involvement. And we get a lot of young teachers teaching. And team teaching seems to me to be a strategic thinking. The thing that bothers me a little bit is, if your Sunday school is synonymous in time, at the same time as your, what's the word? When it's not the same time. Yeah, at the same time as your family Bible hour, you have your Sunday school sometimes. The weakness of that is, the strengths and weaknesses in everything. That's what I'm trying to get across. Nothing's perfect and nothing's all wrong. But whenever you have a strength, there's an inherent weakness. If you have your key young people always in the Sunday school teaching, then they're missing some of the other things. I like the idea of team teaching. My 17-year-old twins are team teachers of kindergarten. And so one Sunday out of four, they're in with the kindergarten kids. The other three Sundays they're in, they're being fed. Little things to keep in mind. Creativity at every point. Questioning what you do and strategic thinking. Maybe even if you don't come up with the best strategy, it's still healthy. Because at least you were thinking. I love your questions. I want to compliment. You are really with it, people. I can tell that. See, I speak to audience. You notice I don't look down at my notes hardly at all. I'm always looking at you. I saw those person there and the person there that fell asleep.
There seems to be a mindset amongst smaller brethren churches that we are the ones that are holding on to the truth, and the bigger churches must be compromising to make it so attractive.
Yeah.
That's why they're growing.
How do
we get that message across that no?
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know how to change. As I mentioned, this John, is your first name, isn't it? Jack. As I tried to say to Jack, I don't really have a lot of answers. Pride is a really bad thing. And when we think that we've got the truth and we've got the methodology, boy, that is so dangerous, and the Holy Spirit usually leaves. And so somehow or other, if people involved in that way of thinking can see for themselves that maybe, with a touch of humility, maybe we're kind of missing the boat a little bit. But fear of the unknown is a dangerous fear. And so that's why I like to introduce and expose people to things. Do you know how we really helped? This is a silly little thing. How we helped Brethren Assemblies in Vancouver become more open? We have fundraising banquets to raise the money for our television ministry. We invite people to come, fill out a pledge form, and put it in on the table in the middle, and then go home. Well, that's not very brethren. You know, at Granville Chapel one time years ago, our income was down, so one of the brothers got up and said, "Brethren, our income has been down lately." "Oh, I said too much," and sat down, our income doubled. See, brethren are usually quite responsible in giving. Whereas, we had these fundraising dinners. Half the people came were brethren, half the people were other denominations. And these brethren people before used to criticize me for going into denominational evangelism. Used to criticize me for going to seminary. But they started coming to these dinners. They started to hear testimonies of people converted to the TV show. They started reading the mail. They started giving. And now, all of the brethren churches in Vancouver, all 17 open brethren churches, support our ministry now. And the people in their church send in pledge cards, prayer cards. We're their one of their missionary operations for the evangelistic operations. In other words, they're not only supporting the brethren works, they're supporting the denominational work. And I think that came slowly and gradually, as they got to see the unknown wasn't so naughty, but there was something actually happening there. The reason I know these things is when I got converted, I went so narrow, I quit bowling. So I know, I was real narrow brethren for about 6 months. You couldn't get narrower. I couldn't figure out why Billy Graham wasn't a brethren. Brethren's the truth. And if he's so good, how did he miss the truth? What was it? Hey, you are really sharp. Oh, that. You're a good guy. He thought he was. Yes. The man in the red shirt first, then the blue shirt.
Okay. What sort of effort guys need in terms of planning their ministry of music and singing?
Of paying the music?
No. Of planning.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. In our church services?
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. That is... See, that's what I tried to say. I wasn't being negative on University Chapel. When they get that real passion for evangelism, oh, that church is just going to... It's right on university campus. It's going to go through the roof. And I'm very good friends with the elders there. I am not negative. I'm prodding. But their worship is so good. And Granville Chapel's picked it up. We have every Sunday about 10 songs. Half older great hymns of Isaac Watts and John Newton and Charles Wesley. And half new. But the new are very, very biblical. We've been blessed. The Christian church has been blessed in the last 20 years by biblical hymns, biblical songs, biblical choruses. Not that when I was converted, we sang a lot of trite choruses 25 years ago. We had the choruses you sing one and that led you to another, and oh, it was just shallow, deep and wide, that type of thing, you know. And slightly better. I am so happy, and here's the reason why. Wash my burdens all away, or something like that. Those maybe suited that era. This is not that era. Now, the music today is so good, I think it's the strongest thing of the Christian church today, is music. They worship, for the worship side, the communication side. So, we sing a combination of both. Everyone is printed up in the song, in the bulletin on Sunday. In other words, our Sunday service counts. So they go to the trouble of typing up and printing out in good quality, proper typing, proper printing, the songs for every Sunday that aren't already in the hymn book. And we get the balance of new and old. Always one or two new, not all new. And we have different ways of doing it different Sundays. We have a choir, the good old traditional choir, every second Sunday or every third Sunday. They sing these, you know, good songs, but it's like a choir of people standing up there. We don't tend to have a song leader anymore. The song leaders, you did an excellent job today, brother. But we don't tend to need to have, that's the way to answer that. We don't tend to need to have the song leader the same we have a worship leader. Just a slight difference. In fact, you were really worship leading this morning. The worship leader basically is directing. And the music isn't so much everybody looking up at the song leader. It's people reading in their own choruses and carried along by the music. And we have the orchestra, we call it participatory worship, where there's several people standing with microphones and they're leading by their voices, not by their hands. And we have a lot of instruments, guitars, violins, cellos, piccolos. We don't have enough drums in our particular church, but different churches have different gifts. And see, Granville Chapel, we're in a staid, high-class, snobby area. We're in the million-dollar home area. And so, you know, we're not exactly a Reuben type of place. Our kids all have short hair. They don't know what long hair is, you know, that kind of thing. Because, you know, they're all prepped yuppies. Well, that word's gone now. And they, you know, we're yuppies when yuppies were in. Everybody drives in their BMW. In our school, my children are a minority in Vancouver. The Chinese community is a majority, and the kids all drive up in their Mercedes and BMWs to school. And so that's the kind of area where we are. And our services are rather dull, rather staid, compared to others that are much more bang, bang, bang on a different socio-economical area. So we don't have to have drums. We have a lot of different participants, but not every song is the same. The service is not the same from beginning to end. There's variety within the service. Some songs, the worship leader may just come up to the podium and say, now we're going to sing such and such hymn. And sometimes Tim does this, our minister. He does lead singing sometimes. Other times, one of the people standing at the three microphones, usually we have at least minimum three, if not four, singers, usually a couple of women and a man. And then any one of them, women equally, men, whatever, you know, say, and now we're going to sing this song and we'll teach it to you. So there's a whole sense of everybody's relaxed, and sometimes we'll do two, three, and four songs in succession, following one after the other. And so we find the printed song sheet for the chorus is so much better than, okay, now I'll turn to song number 552, and you turn to that, and okay, I'll now to 332. That's hard to sing sequentially when you're using a book. The sequential mostly comes from the printed song sheet, printed for the Sunday. So we really stress music all across Canada well now. And that is really coming in. I was on the Younger Leaders Committee for Lausanne, for the Lausanne Congress on World Evangelism. And we in 1987 had a conference in Singapore, and I was in charge of the evening worship. And what I did is I transposed University Chapel's worship service to the younger leaders of the world, from every culture all the way around. And they went for it like gangbusters. Peter Kuzmic from Yugoslavia was there, and he came to me after and said, Terry, this music at this conference has been fantastic. The traditional conference is song, Bible passage, speaker. Well, we wanted to really inject the spirit of worship. So we brought all the overhead slides, and by the way, use overheads a lot. Overheads, people look up as opposed to looking down. And all nicely printed, really done well. And then all organized ahead of time in the order they're going to be played, so it's not a lot of, last-minute-ishness. And so they put the overhead projector on. We did in Singapore every night, and we had Leighton Ford's son playing the guitar, and we had all these different people up there. I had the Bowker brothers, two pianists from Canada who work in our crusades. They came all the way from Vancouver to Singapore just to play the piano. We had two grand pianos on the stage each night, and it was a spirit of worship for half an hour before the message each time. And people really loved it. We call it participatory worship. Lots of participation of the people. Not so much one director and 95 respondents. More everybody worshiping together. And it's not hyped up. I brought a lot of people to University Chapel to show them how to run a worship service, and they ahead of time thought that this was going to be psyched up. And they all walked away and said, that was sweet. That was the word that came. That was sweet. Our time is sort of running out. What time should we stop? At now, Cedric, or you're in charge? Well, let's say five more minutes, and then we can break for the famous Australian lunch.
You're talking about a worship service. Yeah. Does that distinct from your breaking of bread,
yeah,
or your growing together?
Good question. Different churches are doing it in different ways now. I don't know the easy solution. Communion is very difficult. It's almost one of the hurdles for a brethren church to be effective. I don't know why it is this way, but our communion kills us more than anything else we do. Some of our communion services are so dead, they're funereal, and they turn our young people off and our adults as well. I don't know if that's true at all in Australia. But some of our brethren worship services in Canada are very dead. We have even a different hymn book, and we don't even sometimes use a piano in the old days. And it was just, it was tradition. It sure wasn't biblical in any way, shape, or form. Some adapted by still having the full hour long, same pattern, a brother gets up, and then this, and then that, and boy, I tell you, talk about, form. But they started to inject livelier songs, started to add the odd piano and the odd guitar, and livened up that way a little bit. The best that I have come across yet, and this is personal preference, and this is a struggle I have, is to know what even, when I'm asked my opinion, and this is only my opinion, I think the best is when we don't have the separate communion service, when it's part of the other service, the larger service. Granville's gone that way, University Chapel's gone that way. There's a downside to that too. Granville actually, I think, has come up with the best solution. They have one service on Sunday morning where communion is in part of the whole family Bible hour, if you want to call it. We don't use that word, but the family Bible hour type service ends with the communion once a month. I like that formula. Then three Sunday nights a month, the small number that like communion every Sunday get together and by the fire, in the fireside room as we call it, and they have an informal communion that has no resemblance to the rather staid older way, where they sing and they sing and they sing, people share passages of scripture and maybe a little message or something, and then they have the communion and maybe a missionary report. But the tone of it is totally warm, cozy by the fire, and it's not that small. That, I think, is the best balance. University Chapel has communion every one of the four Sundays, part of the morning service. And that's where I don't know if the service is geared to non-Christians. Because if you're a non-Christian and everybody else takes communion, you're not. You're the goat and they're the sheep. No matter how it's explained or whatever, if it's every Sunday. Once in a month, somehow or other, well, that's the way to do things in the church here, and it's sort of nice, and you know, they're only a goat that one week, and they've got three more a week when they're part of everybody else, and by the next week they're converted, and they're taking it too. So that's my personal preference. Communion, you've got to be more strategic on communion than anything else you do in your churches. That is for sure. The answer, I don't know. The answer will be different for all of you. But I think that you want to liven up your communion services so they're joy, so they're worship, so you're loving the Lord, and everybody's singing. Oh, I love those. Have you ever noticed at camps you have your best communion? Okay, move it into Sunday in your church. Maybe that's a good way to end. Thank you for those excellent questions.